briefly introduce my co-counsel, Stephen Miro, and Lenann Westcott. Thank you.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Jessica Zeldin from Rosenthal Monheit. I also rise to do a couple of introductions. With me today at council table is Lawrence Deutsch from the Berger & Montague firm and Robin Switzenbaum, also from Berger & Montague. Mr. Deutsch will be making today's argument on behalf of appellee Chuck Ginsburg.
Welcome.
Thank you. Your Honor, Mr. Lafferty, on behalf of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange and the individual defendants below, with me at council table is Stephen Kastenberg from Ballard Spahr in Philadelphia. And with Your Honor's permission, I'll be making the presentation on behalf of my clients.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
This is Paul Lockwood on behalf of Merrill Lynch. There are several lawyers, there's too many to introduce, actually, who represent other of the strategic investor defendants in the case. And I'm going to be making a short argument on behalf of all of them.
Whomever you may be, welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Michael Maimone of Edwards Angel Palmer & Dodge, representing the certification appellants. May it please the court. My clients are challenging only the class certification aspect of the settlement, not the other aspects of the settlement. I'll leave that to the other appellants to challenge. This action involves a series of transactions that extended from April 20th, 2005 to August 16th, 2005, which resulted in the control of Philex, the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, being transferred from the public stockholders of Philex to six large financial institutions. The last act challenged in this action was disclosed in a press release dated August 16th, 2005, and the transfer of control of Philex violated the Philex Charter. Notwithstanding the fact that the wrongdoing ended on August 16, 2005, the class period being challenged here by my clients extends to June 20, 2007, almost 2 years after the wrongdoing. From my client's point of view, there are two legal issues relevant to this appeal. The first issue is whether stockholders that were not injured by wrongful conduct should be permitted to collect money damages in a class action settlement. The second issue is whether a violation of the Philex Charter may be remedied through a class action settlement absent unanimous stockholder approval. If this court holds that the answer to either of these questions is no, then the class certification decision of the Court of Chancery should be reversed. In connection with the first issue, in their opening brief, my clients asked appellees one simple question. What was the injury suffered by the members of the class that acquired shares after August 16, 2005? In 87 pages of answering briefs, appellees could not identify a single injury. Appellees spoke in terms of giving up an interest or a claim to enforce the Philex Charter, but could not identify a single injury. Because stockholders that acquire stock after wrongful conduct are not injured, and the appellees couldn't identify an injury, such stockholders should not be members of the class and should not collect money damages. And the authority that supports this proposition could be found in our opening brief at 22 through 24, our reply brief 10 through 11, primarily this court's decision in Witt Capital, which is cited in the reply brief.
Is one of the potential outcomes of the allocation hearing an award of zero?
That is a potential outcome.
Well, does that solve the problem?
The answer is no, it doesn't solve the problem, because the fact that members of the class are being considered for distribution of damages when they shouldn't be is a problem in and of itself. In addition, it was the...
Well, maybe you better flesh out for me why it is a problem in and of itself, given Justice Risley's question.
It's a problem in and of itself because It's a problem in and of itself because there will be consideration given to members of the class that were not injured. And that consideration may result in monetary damages for that class. There's two roads to get to the right place. The first road is to exclude these stockholders from the class. The other road is to include them, but the result being zero. That doesn't mean both roads are the appropriate roads. The fundamental premise is you must be injured to be a member of the class. These stockholders were not injured. So although the result may be ultimately the same, it's, in my client's view, inappropriate for them to be included in a class where if they are considered for monetary damages. There will be a negotiation, but currently it will be a negotiation between plaintiff's counsel and plaintiff's counsel to divide up the money. And plaintiff's counsel is the person that created this expanded class. And then ultimately, maybe, the result may be zero. In addition, this is the system that appellees set up. Our position is that all this should have been decided already before we burden the court with this appeal. But this aspect of the appeal was made final, not by anything my clients did, but by what appellees did. They decided to bifurcate this action, not my clients. And because of this bifurcation, it creates uncertainty as to what my clients will receive in the actual allocation. Granted, if after the allocation, we're likely to be back here again if stockholders that were not injured didn't receive it, if they actually received money. But the truth of the matter is they don't belong there in the first place.
It sounds to me like the argument is more work than is necessary will have to be done, even if the ultimate result is zero. Is there no way to compensate for that if the result is zero? And it's to use the colloquialism, it's a no harm, no foul situation?
Well, it would be a no harm, no foul situation if the result is zero. But my client's view is that notwithstanding the result may be zero, the fact that the stockholders that acquired after August 16th, 2005 are even being considered a proper party for damage recovery is a wrong that we're here to address today. Granted, the better procedure would have been for the Court of Chancery not to bifurcate this situation. It would have been not to create a final order under Rule 54 and for us not to be here today, but that's not the situation we have, and it's not a situation that my clients created. It is a situation that appellees created, and we, to preserve our rights, we have to be here today and defend our rights. And we view that the exclusion of these stockholders from the class is the proper remedy. Granted, the same result would occur if it's a zero recovery, but that doesn't mean that's the proper remedy. The proper remedy here and today is to exclude these stockholders from the class.
Reading between the lines, you said earlier that there will be a dispute among the various plaintiffs about allocation, correct?
Correct.
And if I gather correctly, part of your concern is that if this larger group is part of the class and isn't taken out of the class, then even though you can make an argument that they should get zero, as a practical matter, there'll be a lot of pressure to give them something, and that by eliminating them from the group, you will put your own class members in a better position.
That is correct, Your Honor. And once again, this is a situation not of our creation, and we would rather be here deciding all issues at once. But based upon the bifurcated nature of this action, we have to be here today to decide this, to at least argue this issue.
I'm not sure, Mr. Milne, whether you wanted to use all your 10 minutes or whether you just wanted a warning that you're running out of time, as my helpful comments are helping you run out of time, or whether you wanted to save it for rebuttal.
May I use another 30 seconds just to get one point out, Your Honor?
Use the time any way you'd like.
Okay, I just want to address the second issue very quickly. In connection with the second issue, the class plaintiff is attempting to settle void acts that are legal nullities and acts that cannot be settled absent unanimous stockholder approval. Specifically, because the structure of a corporation, the separation of ownership and management, stockholders have certain protections. One protection for stockholders is the provisions of the charter. Contractual rights between the state, the corporation, and the stockholders, and these provisions cannot be violated. For almost 100 years, stockholders have taken comfort in the law of the state that, one, actions that violate the charter are void, not voidable, but void, and two, that to resurrect these actions, these void actions, unanimous stockholder approval is required. In this action, the attempt to settle void acts absent unanimous stockholder approval is contrary to Delaware law and strips each stockholder of Filex of the right to enforce the Filex charter. Indeed, to adopt appellee's view would turn Delaware law on its head because such view would, number one, permit one stockholder to commence an action to enforce a charter provision, and two, to permit that single stockholder to settle the action for all stockholders without unanimous stockholder approval. This is what's happening here, and this is completely undercuts the unanimous stockholder approval requirement, and I have 1 minute left, Your Honor, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning again. Bob Valhura, on behalf of nine former seat owners of the Philadelphia Stock Exchange, whose seats were exchanged just over 4 years ago for stock in the demutualized Philex. Most of these appellants continue to have working relationships with the exchange, and each, by virtue of their former ownership, seat ownership, has a claim against the exchange, which has been the subject of an action in the Federal District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, relating to, among other things, demutualization. This morning, I'd like to focus my very limited time on the issues of the scope of the release granted by the court below. As set forth in our briefs, we believe the trial court erred in approving the settlement with a broad release sought by the appellees. The gravamen of this action, as set forth in plaintiff's complaint, an amended complaint, was an attack on the failure of the Philex and its governing board to accept the transaction with Archipelago and thereafter their agreement to enter into a sale of the exchange to the six so-called strategic investors. These acts took place over a year and a half after the seat owners had their ownership interest exchanged into stock and the exchange was demutualized. Appellees now contend that despite everything to the contrary, the demutualization of the exchange is the core operative fact relating to the plaintiff's cause of action against the defendants. First, we believe that Your Honor should find the class had no standing with respect to pursuing claims relating to these alleged core operative facts. Thus, had no basis upon which to have the release granted here at all. Second, we believe the court should find that the facts relating to demutualization, unlike as determined by the court below, are tangential facts and not core facts from which the settlement release is appropriately granted. As for our first argument, Your Honors, assuming for the moment the operative facts in the action include demutualization, which we dispute, the class as defined here could not have brought these claims arising out of demutualization since, as defined, the class itself are holders of stock as of April 20th, 2005, the time of the rejection of the Archipelago transaction, and not as of the time of the demutualization over a year and a half before. Such lack of standing of the class does not provide a basis upon which release covering demutualization can be granted. And what may be just as significant, Your Honors, is the fact that even if the class of stockholders were holding shares earlier or defined to be holding shares following the demutualization, those claims relating to wrongs occurring with respect to demutualization, where those very things that were released in this settlement belong not to the stockholders, those claims belong not to the stockholders, but rather to the former seat owners. And thus, these purported class members as stockholders simply do not have the requisite standing to raise, litigate, and or release any of the claims relating to the former seat owners relating to the arising out of demutualization. Alternatively, the second ground for reversal of the trial court's determination where the releases were sufficient in scope is that the settlement releases claims based upon non-operative facts. The Archipelago deal and the sale transaction are what the stockholders were led to believe this action was about, as what was litigated, as evidenced by the causes of action against the exchange and the strategic investors. When the settlement was concluded and made public, for the first time, the Philex stockholders were told that the claims relating to demutualization, claims that were never the focus of the cause of action, were now the core of this case and were being settled. How this change happened and why it did is not of importance, but rather the overbreadth of the release, as approved by the court below, is. Over appellants' strenuous objections, the court below entered the order specifically including language releasing claims based on non-core facts. As this court is held in...
So there is basically a finding by the chancellor as to what the core of the class action is?
I believe the court did find in its oral ruling that the core of the facts that were litigated were involved demutualization. Yes, Your Honor.
And is that... erroneous? As a
matter of we believe it was, Your Honor, because what was litigated in this case, which was what was pled in the pleadings of the parties, were the claims relating to the Archipelago deal, as well as the sales to the six investors. It is our contention that those claims, anything that was relating to the demutualization, was in fact an introductory facts and not the core facts. If you look at what was litigated here, Your Honor, you'll see that it was focused on the Archipelago deal as well as the deal relating to the six strategic investors.
So you're saying that these were introductory facts instead of core facts, and there is some standard by which introductory facts can't be the basis of a release, but core facts can?
Well, it's a very good question, Your Honor, and that brings me to my next point, which is if this court wanted to have a standard by which all facts in a complaint could be released, it would have stated that. In Nottingham Partners, it would have said all facts in a complaint are those are the facts that you can release. It did not do so. It uses same operative facts, and for the word operative to have some meaning, it has to be something less than all facts. And I believe that operative facts are those facts which are operate on the claims that were being brought before the court. And the claims here relate to Archipelago and the six the sales to the six strategic investors. The complaint, as I've mentioned, there are no denominated causes of action against demutualization. After they had a chance with the investigate some of their claims, they amended their complaint. There are no claims relating to demutualization in the amended complaint. Yet all those causes of action flow specifically from the rejected Archipelago transaction and the sales to the six strategic investors. Quite possibly the most telling of all is what the scope of the class plaintiff has asked this court below to approve, and that was a class defined to include all stockholders of the Philex from April 20th, 2005 forward. Plaintiff's not even attempting to go back a year and a half to claim that any harm happened as a result of that demutualization. Thus, we believe the conclusive piece of evidence relating to the demutualization was not a cause of action and was not a core fact, was the fact that class was never defined to include those persons who owned stock at the time of demutualization.
If you were to prevail on this argument, where would that leave your clients? I mean, obviously that would take them out of this settlement, correct?
No, Your Honor, it would keep them in the – well, you're sending it back to the court. With a direction to assume if what you're talking about is having a narrow release entered, we would be bound by those things going from April 20th, 2005 forward, and that release would be effective as to my client from that point forward, but not as to claims relating to demutualization, Your Honor.
And what would that mean as a practical matter? Where would that leave your clients with respect to demutualization?
Well, we would not have to face a claim in the litigation in Philadelphia that the release barred them from pursuing claims relating to the demutualization of the Philex.
I take it that response inherently means that hasn't, or the scope of the release here hasn't been litigated in any other.
I believe it has been pled and used, but I do not believe it has been decided as of this point. I see that I've reached my time, and I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Lawrence Deutschberger Montague on behalf of Plaintiff Chuck Ginsburg and the class. We're here because we had an exceptional settlement in this case that's valued at almost $100 million. That includes the return of 14% of the shares of the strategic investor defendants, as well as 14% of the share rights of defendant CEO Frueser, as well as some anti-dilution provisions, in addition to $17 million being provided to the class. This case was only settled literally the day before trial under a mediation in front of Vice Chancellor Lamb. The claims we settled were basically equitable claims. That is, we initially sought rescission of the sales to the strategic investors or alternatively rescissionary damages. The case centered on the violation of the charter of the FILEX and how the board of directors breached their fiduciary duty by allowing a violation such that a related group of parties could purchase 90% of the shares of the FILEX. As the chancellor observed, this case was fiercely litigated, hammer and tong, as hard as he had seen in 22 years. Now, today, I'm going to try to address the class certification attacks that have been made, while the other appellees focus upon release and the question of whether or not a violation of the charter has to be resolved only by unanimous shareholder vote. The standard for review on class certification of the chancellor's decision below is abuse of discretion. There's been no facts shown here by any of the appellants that would challenge that finding here. The court's reasoning below was well-reasoned. In fact, the only real question they seem to really be raising is an intra-class question about who gets what in this settlement. It's not challenging the volume or value of this settlement, just questions of allocation, which the chancellor below, under the facts of this case, decided that something will decide subsequently after the settlement is finalized. And indeed, the grounds he used for that is that the FILEX also has an opportunity here to have a substantial transaction, which will be to the benefit of this class if that transaction is able to go through. Now, the three basic attacks that the appellants raised on class, one is class definition, second was adequacy of class representative, and the third was adequacy of counsel. Specifically, they focus on the question of who could be in this class and specifically attack transferees who purchased their shares after August 16th of 2005. What they ignore here is the evolution of this case, that we had opinions in the case, we had facts in the case, and most saliently, the chancellor made a ruling in December of 2006 where he focused upon the breach of fiduciary duty arising from the breach of the charter. And from that, that's where you evolve into the class definition that we developed in this case.
Let me stop you right there. Opposing counsel said, no, I asked to find out what injury was suffered by the extended class, what they consider to be the extended class moving after August of 2005. What's your answer?
Well, first, I'd like to just take one step back to answer your question. That is, they focus on this case with capital where they say that an element of class is that you have to show injury at the time of the class certification. But that was a New York contract-based case, and it's not really on point to what we have here, which is a breach of fiduciary duty case where the elements are breach, whether or not there's a duty and whether or not that duty is breached. The question I think you're actually asking is, what are the damages to everybody in this class? And indeed, there are damages for everybody in this class, including all the way through the class period. The damage that continues on an ongoing basis is the breach of the charter of the FILEX, such that every shareholder over that whole period of time was injured by those actions.
So it's an ongoing breach argument.
That's correct. And appellants challenged or used this August 16, 2005 date as though it's the end of all issues in dispute in the case, and that's belied by the facts and the decisions in this case. First of all, in the initial class definition we provided, which was in the amended complaint, we referred to all shareholders that will be harmed because we anticipated that it was an ongoing injury to any class A holder. And most significantly, we also moved to enjoin the issuance of additional shares once the strategic investors had satisfied their warrants. We did that in June of 2006. Now, we were unsuccessful in that, but it shows the ongoing nature of the injury to the Class A shares in this case. Now, in addition to that example of August 16th, 2005, not being a really credible cutoff point in this case, shortly after August of 2005, in September of 2005, the FILEX has a tender offer to these shareholders. And what's significant is that the tender offer discloses the degree of dilution of these Class A shareholders. So that's a relevant fact after this August 16th date. In addition, in February 2006, one of the strategic investors exercises its warrant and gets its additional shares. And in turn, the other strategic investors only get their additional shares by July of 2006. And most importantly, the very gravamen of the case is that on an ongoing basis, we allege that the strategic investors took control of the FILEX, and that was an ongoing violation of the charter. Now, this case, this class in which we've put the transferees into the class is no different than a variety of Delaware cases, TriArc, Sun States, Emerald Partners, where you have holders, buyers, transferees. There's nothing unusual about it, and for the facts of this case, it's certainly appropriate. In short, the class definition was congruent with the facts and the court opinion of this specific case. Now I turn shortly to an attack made on the class representative that he was inadequate for this case. Now, obviously, he vigorously litigated the case because it went right up to the date of trial. He undoubtedly has had standing. He's a holder. He was a holder at the beginning of the case. He's a holder to this very day. And even significantly, he's neither a seller nor a buyer. So the purported concern over a conflict that he or we, the class counsel, will be biased against buyers or sellers is simply unfounded. Similarly, there's an attack on class counsel where they raise a question as though we're somehow doing the bidding of one of the class members, Susquehanna. What they seem to ignore is that Susquehanna actually objected to our settlement. So the factual basis for this just doesn't exist, and they don't provide any support for that. Now, in sum, the class has been correctly defined, and there has been no disabling conflicts. Therefore, the class was properly certified and represented in this case. Now, there's one other argument that has been raised, not an oral argument, but in their reply briefs, and that concerns subclasses. Now, at this point, the chancellor has indicated that his plan is to go ahead with a plan of allocation. If there's any intra-class disputes, he'd be willing to hear them and deal with them. That's an orderly way to do these. Nobody's raised the issue of subclasses prior to the time where there's a concrete settlement in place. So the need for any subclasses here is wholly speculative at this point in time. Now, there was also an argument, again, not raised at all.
Let me interrupt for a second. Are you saying then that if and when this case goes back, if the circumstances arise suggesting that there is a need for subclasses, that the trial court could then take care of it by creating subclasses?
The chancellor has indicated that that's something he might do. I would say this case isn't so distinctive from many cases in which we work on, which in a class, oftentimes there are intra-class disputes as to when somebody has damages, whose damages are greater than another member in the class, particularly in a securities fraud case. You have to evaluate where disclosures occurred and who should get which component of any settlement.
Well, to summarize, is it accurate to say that all of the objections being raised on appeal can be resolved in the allocation process? Is
that yes, I think the exception would be the release argument, which the exchange appellees will be addressing. Yes, to our understanding, everything could be handled in the allocation process. The chancellor, who is very familiar with the record in this case and even the pending potential disputes, can certainly handle that. My
time. May it please the court. I'm going to address two issues, the voidness issue that Mr. Maimon raised in his opening argument and the scope of the release. The voidness issue that appellants raise now was never raised below. It was never raised in their opening brief and appeared for the first time in their reply brief in this appeal. The basic position is that they assert is that a claim for breach of a charter can never be settled absent unanimous stockholder approval. We submit again, the reasoning is that a charter violation claim allegedly is a void act. We submit that that's wrong as a matter of law. The court, first of all, ought to reject this newly minted argument for the reason that it wasn't raised below and wasn't raised in an opening brief. But even if you consider the merits, what my colleagues miss is the fact that this charter violation claim was simply that. It was a claim. It was unadjudicated. There was never a finding below of any void or even voidable act. There was no finding of a charter violation at all. Indeed, the court below found that the plaintiffs had a steep hill to climb, uphill climb at trial, that they survived a motion to dismiss by the skin of their teeth, that summary judgment was a close call, that the defendants had strong defenses to the claims in this case, and that there were all kinds of practical and legal problems with the plaintiff's case. So far from a finding of a void act or a charter violation at all, there was nothing but an unadjudicated claim, and therefore the shareholder ratification cases that my colleagues cite are simply not on point. Moreover, even if there were a charter violation found in this case, there is certainly no basis to conclude that that would have resulted in a finding of a void act. The cases that my colleagues cite, Star Surgical, Triplex, involved violations of a charter or a statute in connection with the creation of stock. Here there was no dispute that the shares issued in the strategic transactions were validly created at the time of demutualization or properly authorized. Indeed, this fact that there would be no finding of a void act, even if a charter violation had been proven, is driven home by the fact that the charter provision at issue here, Article 4, includes remedies that are built right in. It expressly contemplated a circumstance under which a person or related persons might come to own greater than 20% of the exchange's common stock. And the remedies that are expressly built into that are basically that the shares, the excess shares, would lose their incidence of ownership, like voting rights. Moreover, the Philex is given the right to buy back shares at par value if it chooses to do so, if there were a violation found. So far, again, a far cry from a finding of a void act. Moreover, analogous case law is directly contrary to my colleague's assertion. Certainly, we know that this court and the Chancery Court have approved settlements involving waste claims. Waste claims fundamentally involve allegations of a void act. And we know that this court and the Court of Chancery have approved settlements where certain shareholders have come in and objected to the settlement of waste claims. And your honors can also look at the Nottingham Partners case, which is one of the seminal cases involving class certification. The claims at issue in that case involved allegations that a recapitalization and a charter amendment were void. The court had no problem concluding that those claims could be settled over the objection of other stockholders. The same is fundamentally true here. Finally, the rule that my colleagues assert would be bad policy. It would allow a stockholder, disgruntled or otherwise, to level a claim of a charter violation against a company, and it basically would set up a rule whereby the company could never settle that claim absent getting that stockholder's approval. It makes no sense, no matter how good a settlement otherwise might be for the class of shareholders. That would be bad policy, we submit. As to the release, Your Honors, to answer a question Your Honor raised, Justice Ridgely, the court below found it was indisputable that demutualization was part of the operative facts of this case. I believe that finding, a fact by the court below, is well supported by the record, and my colleagues have cited nothing in the record that points otherwise.
Can you point to the record where that finding is made? Because what I think I heard was the finding was never made, and now I'm hearing the finding was made.
Actually, Mr. Valahura said that he concurred that the chancellor did find that it was part of the operative facts of the case.
Well, I missed that.
He conceded that. And it is in the transcript in the court below. I don't have the page reference as I stand here, but so, indisputable is the word the chancellor
used.
So
the issue is whether or not that finding is an abuse of discretion.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. And that was not an abuse of discretion. The bottom line is that the record well supports the fact that demutualization was part of the operative facts of this case. You look at the complaint. I mean, there are serious allegations of wrongdoing leveled against my clients in connection with demutualization. Is there a cause of action? No.
Could you be specific?
Certainly.
What paragraph?
Your Honor, I can get you all the references, but, for example, in the complaint itself, the amended complaint, they allege things like my clients fraudulently induced seed owners and stockholders to vote in favor of demutualization, that they coerced
seed owners into voting for demutualization by making certain promises or threatening the imposition of fees. Paragraph 57 of the amended complaint. Paragraph 61, there are allegations arising there over a special dividend right they claim to be entitled to that was put in place out of demutualization. And my colleagues conceded below that this demutualization was, in fact, a factual predicate. They even said below, in the court below, that the theft of their shares began with demutualization. It was part and parcel of this case, and the chancellor was correct. Your Honor, sorry, I'm out of time.
Paul Lockwood, and I'm speaking here for the six strategic investor defendants. To bring a practical approach to this, the arguments made by the objectors suggest that they can tweak the terms of the settlement and that these issues that they've raised are incidental to the settlement. When they go to the central elements of the settlement, from our perspective, we are providing the lion's share of the proceeds of this settlement, and if we are not able to obtain the finality that you generally get in the settlement, those proceeds are not going to be there. And the way we approached this settlement was we wanted the standard terms that you get in a class action in the Court of Chancery. And the terms that provided us with finality were, one, the class definition. And the class definition includes all those persons who claim to have rights against us. And the transferees.
Including people who claim to have rights against you with respect to demutualization?
Well, demutualization goes beyond my client's interest. That goes to the Philex's interest. My clients, the strategic investors got involved after demutualization. So from our own selfish perspectives, the case against us concerns our investments. There's a broader set of claims and rights against the directors. So there are some events that preceded our investment that are the subject of fiduciary duty claims against the directors. The claims against us relate to our investments.
Well, I understand that as a general rule, defendants like to see a settlement cover everything that could possibly come up or that has arisen. But there seems to be a real concern here that there's ongoing federal litigation and that the release is overbroad here. I know that may not be your clients, but you started out your argument by saying, look, we're in this and we're providing the money or a substantial part of it, and we're doing it in exchange for getting everything resolved. So that means you've got to answer this question.
With respect to anything that concerns my clients, and we are defendants in the federal lawsuit in Philadelphia, and if there are claims left against us in that case, because they seek rescission of our investments in both cases, in Delaware and in Pennsylvania. The only way we're going to settle this case is if no one has a right to come after us to rescind our investments, because it's silly for us to give them $80 million worth of stock and then turn around and get hauled into court in Philadelphia and have the same rescission hanging over our head. So it was central to our willingness to participate in the settlement that there be a standard release, which the Matsushita case provides, which is that the core operative facts are going to be released under federal or state law. Because if we didn't have that, then we would just face double liability. We'd be paying this huge settlement, and we'd be getting nothing for it because we'd still get tagged with a rescission claim in Philadelphia. So we weren't willing to proceed without that.
Thank you very much. I'm trusting that you have another minute. I think I understand the issues in the case better than I understand how to operate this clock, but I think you have a minute.
I'll be brief, Your Honor. Thank you. Just to respond, we did not raise the charter violation point in our opening brief for a very simple reason. We asked, what was the injury? Where's the beef? And my friend couldn't give us an injury. And, in fact, when Justice Berger asked right now what was the injury, my friends still can't create an injury. But they did say, well, it's the charter violation that brings everyone into the class. And my friends also say that you can't settle charter violations. I disagree. If you have a claim for a charter violation, one of two things are going to happen. The first thing that's going to happen is you're going to prove your claim and there's a charter violation, which can't be settled, or you don't have a charter violation, so there's no claim and it can't be settled. Charter violations are special. Charter violations go to the fundamental relationship between the state, the company, and the stockholders. And to violate the charter destroys the protections that stockholders have when they invest in Delaware companies. And my friends cannot point to one case, where a charter violation was settled, and not even Sun States, which was a provisional order, not a final order, but a provisional order. didn't settle the charter violation because the charter violation claim was dismissed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Once again, I wanted just to point out where in the record you can find where the Chancellor made his decision on this respect to the claims, whether they're core operative facts, and you can find that on page 95 and 96 of the transcript. And the Chancellor sums up this after going through all the claims. He says, all those circumstances and claims comprise the operative facts out of which this settlement arose, and not out of which the facts of the case were presented to the court with respect to claims that were being litigated, Your Honor.
Does that mean I interpreted your earlier argument correctly? You weren't conceding that these demutualization was an operative fact?
I am not conceding that demutualization is an operative fact. That is correct, Your Honor. I am not. However, that the court did find, as I just read, that it was, in fact, a operative fact out of which the settlement arose, which is the fight that took place here. And indeed, as we've just heard this morning, they want that complete freedom to avoid the claims in the federal district court. If they wanted that freedom, they should have brought those claims into the litigation here, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you very much for an interesting argument. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.